Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 16th, 2007, and this is show number 112. This week's car care tip is not about waxing or claying or any care of the paint at all. It's about chrome care. You see, I was at a wedding recently where I was swapping car care stories with my friend Dave. Yeah, I'm a hoot at parties. Anyway, we got on the subject of how to care for chrome rims. I don't have chrome myself, but Steve prefers them on his cars. I don't think they're worth the money. They do look cool, but man, they're expensive. Anyway, Kyle's driving Steve's 2000 Accord with chrome wheels, and while they look good, they've been oxidizing a bit and also had some bad water spots on them from sprinklers. I tried one chrome polish. I wish I could remember the name or even find the bottle, because when it came time to rub this stuff off, I could not get it off. Dave says it's supposed to take elbow grease to get the polish off, but this was ridiculous. I mean, I'm just like grinding away on it. I finally managed to get most of it off, but I swore I would never try it again. Dave suggested I try Mother's chrome polish. So, with trepidation, I decided to give it a try on Kyle's wheels this weekend. I did, and it worked great. I could tell it was working even while I was putting it on because the wheels felt really rough when I first started rubbing it on, but as I kept rubbing, fairly gently, it would slowly become smooth. I wasn't having to rub all that hard at all, but I was still worried. My cloth came away dark gray, so I must have been getting some bad stuff off, I figured. Later, when it had dried to a haze, it came off quite easily, and the rims looked much better than they did before I got started. I've always used Mother's clay, and now I'm a fan of their chrome polish, too. I do not recommend their wax, though. Somehow it shows back up like a week later in spots you weren't careful, as though you weren't careful rubbing it off. But it's like in really obvious spots, like the middle of the hood, there'll be some wax. And you're like, how could I have missed that? So it just keeps coming back and back, and it's really annoying, especially on a black car. So for waxing, I use Meguiar's products and, of course, Zano for polishing. Well, that's it for our car tips of the week with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. I really like how many people are writing to me lately. I'm getting lots of great letters. Nothing like a free offer of a sketch invite to get people talking to me. But anyway, I think people for some reason are afraid of bothering the host or something, but I'm still able to keep up with the mail at this level, so keep sending the emails. I really enjoy hearing from you. Well, Tim of Butterfly Poop fame sent in a tip related to last week's show, where I talked through Kyle's tip using Command Option and the left-right arrows to switch between tabs on Firefox. Hope you remember that. If you don't, go back and listen to last week's show. Anyway, Tim writes, thought you should know you may move between tabs in Safari also with Command Shift and the left and right curly looking brace. That's kind of a nice tip, Tim. I tried it and it worked. It seemed to sometimes not react to me though, like it would do three tab hops, but then not the fourth one. And I'd wait a little while and do it again, and then it would do it. I wonder why that is. Tim went on to say, I've been using Safari 3 beta for Windows at work. One of the things that has been bugging me is that the other applications like Thunderbird are always opening links in a new Safari window. Very frustrating having all those windows open. Then I found out there is a Windows Merge All Windows capability, which is a sufficient resolution. It's also in the Safari window menu for Mac. I hate that too, Tim. That's a tip I never heard of before. I tested it and it works well. I can't swear that this is in Safari 3 for Windows because, well, frankly, I'm too lazy to launch Parallels right now. But in Safari 3 for the Mac, under Preferences on the General tab, there's a radio button that lets you tell Safari to open links from applications in a new tab in the current window instead of a new window. You might have yours set to open them in a new window. Even with that set, though, I still find myself with a lot of Safari windows open, so some applications may not be behaving themselves. I'll definitely be using the Merge All Windows command, too. Thanks for the tips. All right. So I'm trying to learn Linux. It's insane. I'm serious. I'm pretty darn tolerant of a little bit of a challenge to using the computer, right? Well, this is just crazy. It's so weird and hard and unintuitive. I spent my day Wednesday in what they call dependency heck. All right, that's the family-friendly version. I better start the story at the beginning. As always, time for a problem statement. My goal is to figure out how to stitch two videos together using command line programs on Linux. Sounds easy enough, right? Jeez, what was I thinking? Imagine first if you were to try to stitch two audio files together. Audio's hard. You know, I mean, there's so many different formats out there. There's MP3 and AAC and Ogg Vorbis, and the list goes on and on. Then you've got different bit rates to deal with. You got 64 kilobits per second or 128 or 256. And then, of course, there's a sample rate. What if one of them's at 44.1 kilohertz and the other's at 22.050? Just think about it. I didn't even by any means describe all of the options on audio, and I just described 18 different combinations. Let's expand that to video. You got MP4 and WMV and DivX and MOV and on and on and on. Add in sample rates and bit rates and frame rates and keyframes, and I haven't even started to talk about what size the video is. What if one of them's at 640 by 480, the other one's at 1024 by 768, or 1280 by 1024? Oh my gosh, this is nuts. I should tell you, I can't do this in any other way but command line programs on Linux, because we're trying to make an automated way to stitch two videos together, and our server and all our software is running on Linux. So don't send me reasons why I should do it in Windows or OS X or anything. It's got to be on Linux, got to be command line. So I found a piece of software called FFmpeg. FFmpeg can be compiled for Linux, OS X, and Windows, so it fits our criteria to try to be as cross-platform as we can. It's also open source, and it has a gabillion options in it for all the variables I just mentioned up above. It's supposed to be able to not only stitch videos together, but to convert them from one format to another, which could be really handy since in my project, I won't be able to necessarily control what format the video's in. So I figured for proof of concept, I would start out with two identical videos. The only way I could guarantee that would be if I created them myself. I created two little videos using QuickTime Pro. For the $30 upgrade from free, you can create video and audio recordings on the Mac. Unfortunately, on Windows, you can only create audio recordings for the $30. Well, anyway, when you're in QuickTime Pro, they naturally save out as .mov files, but you can also export them as AVIs or MPEG-4s or a whole host of other options. Around now was when I figured out I was really in trouble, because it turns out saying AVI doesn't actually define the file structure. AVI is what they call a container, and inside the container, you choose how to encode and decode. Hence the term codec. So you're going to encode and decode within AVI the video and audio in two different ways. I know I'm probably not explaining this exactly right for the big video audio files, but I think that what it means is within AVI, you can encode the video as a bunch of different things like H.264 or MPEG-4, for example, and then the audio could be MP3 or AAC. You see why I'm starting to get insane here? And I haven't even gotten to the Linux part yet. Basically, video is really, really hard. Well, rather than continue to booger my explanation of containers and codecs, let's move on to why Linux is making me crazy. I encoded the videos as AVIs with some random sort of codecs, and then I moved them over to Linux. I was using Ubuntu for this task. I make it sound easy. Move them over to Linux. Well, I'm running Linux on my Mac under Parallels, so the two OSs are actually on the same machine. I tried all kinds of ways to move the files between the two. There's no easy parallel shared folders like there is in Windows on Parallels. I even resorted at one point to copying the files from the Mac up to the website box.net, and then on Linux launching a browser and pulling them back down. But my files got bigger than 10 megabytes, so even that solution wasn't going to work. Well, finally, I found instructions on how to set up the Mac side to set up remote logging on the sharing preference pane. Once I had that done, all I had to do was spend about 6 hours trying to figure out how to secure shell on the Linux side back into the Mac. Odd that I found myself wishing for the simple right-click mount disk on Windows. Never thought I'd miss Windows. Well, finally, once I got this figured out, I could move files freely back and forth between Ubuntu and OS X. I started trying to use this FFmpeg program now to stick my files together. Of course, it did not work. Sometimes it told me I had an invalid input format. Sometimes it was an invalid output format. When I was really lucky, it would tell me that the frame rate might be wrong. I hacked away at this, which is my process methodology of sort of like a combo of a weed whacker and a machete, just battling away, just flinging through it, trying all different things. I did that for about 2 weeks until one of the guys I'm working with came back from vacation, who's quite versant in Linux. Sadly, he was as baffled as I was about what was wrong, but he did point out that I was using a 2004 version of FFmpeg. He also scoffed that I was using the wrong version of Linux. That's one of my favorite things about Linux. Whichever distribution you're using, or distro as we Linux heads say, whoever your next Linux helper is, they're going to tell you the one you're using is garbage and to use their favorite. I really wish I were joking here, but it's really absurd how they all have their favorites. Word on the street is that one of the reasons Linux hasn't gained traction as a commercial OS for the regular guy is it keeps splintering it off in all these different distributions, so it's hard to pick which one. Well, anyway, my buddy agreed that it was okay if I used CentOS, which was darn lucky because I happen to already have that loaded on Parallels on my Mac. I jumped on there and typed in FFmpeg in a terminal, and it didn't have FFmpeg loaded. Oh no, this is where the misery really begins. I have to install software on Linux. I need some spooky, scary music to play right here. Dun, dun, dun. All right, so Linux uses what they call packages as installer files, and they use package managers to do the installing of those packages. With me so far? Doesn't sound too bad. Luckily, they also include package installer and finder applications on the different distros. Ubuntu has a lovely one called Synaptic Package Manager, but the one on CentOS isn't nearly as nicely done. All right, so my buddies convinced me to go off to the command line to do the installation. I go out on the web and I find the FFmpeg package and I download it. Luckily, it lands on the desktop, just itching to be double-clicked. In the real world, this would be the last step before starting the project, wouldn't it? How silly of you to think that. No, about 5 more hours will go by before I can actually start. I double-click it, and it starts to install, only to tell me that it needs these other 8 files before it can start. These files have helpful names like liblaxo1, or something like that. All right, so now what do? I enlist another Linux buddy of mine, and he says, oh heck, you're running CentOS 4.3. You should probably upgrade it to 4.5, you know. Heck, those library files are probably in the new one anyway. Okay, I'm game. So we use something called Yum to do this, not to be confused with the fabulous recipe application Yum for the Mac from nickzance.com. Yum is a command line statement. I have no idea what it actually does, but it caused the terminal window to fill up with piles and piles of glop on the screen. My friend was happy. He said it was going great. He said the first thing it does is it downloads the header files. Then it looks at all the header files to see if there's any dependencies. Cue up the scary music again. Remember the foreshadowing on the word dependencies. All right, so all I have to do is find those files, right? All right, about Bart now, Bart gives me the advice to install RPM Forge, whatever that is. But he says life will be much easier if I will just have that installed. When installed, I'll be able to wave my hand at Linux and say FFmpeg and it will work. Or at least that's what I interpret his instructions as meaning. So I install RPM Forge and guess what? It's got
dependencies.
Oh wait, I forgot to tell you one thing though. Every time you search for these stinking packages, you're out on the web and you're thinking, okay, this is the one I want that's going to fit this dependency. You have to sift through a gigantic pile of identical looking names. There's not like one you click that says Linux and Mac and OS and Windows. All of them are compiled for Red Hat Enterprise Level 4 or Red Hat Enterprise Level 5 or Fedora Core 4, maybe Fedora Core 5, and on and on and on. And within all of those, they've been compiled within each of those for i386 or x64, maybe even Spark and PowerPC. The possibilities are almost as plentiful as there are codec options in video. Okay, I gotta calm down. I'm 15 minutes into the show and I haven't talked about the Mac yet, but anyway, I'm gonna finish this story. So, I get these dependencies, right? I can't install this package till I find the one it depends on. I use Google to find the one I need, which of course ends up needing another one, and another one, and another one. Well, I finally beat RPM Forge in a submission and sit back with satisfaction. And what exactly did Bart say I was supposed to do with this? Shoot, I didn't even pay attention during that part. Now it's the middle of the night in Ireland, so I can't ask him. Okay, fine. I give up on that path and I go back to searching out every stinking little package that FFmpeg depends on. And by the end, I didn't even care if it said the package was in Polish and was for an Atari system. I was downloading that bad boy and see what would happen. Well, would you believe that after only 5 short hours, I was able to get FFmpeg to load? And then I went home to dinner. Well, you remember listener James, right? The annoying one? He accidentally sent me something really cool. We all love Google Earth, right? But what if you could use real ground maps for a flight simulator? Wouldn't that be awesome? First thing you need to do is upgrade your Google Earth to the latest version. The one I found was 4.2.0180.1134 beta, but your mileage may vary. Click on the map and then hold down Command, Option, and the letter A. This brings up a window that allows you to choose between an F-16 or an SR-22 as your plane of choice, and also to choose your start position. You can simply start wherever you are in Google Earth at the time, or you can choose from several airports or from your last position in the flight simulator. If you've got a joystick, you can use that too. Otherwise, you can use the myriad of flight simulator shortcuts. I should warn you, the keyboard shortcuts don't work necessarily on a laptop keyboard. For example, the most basic controls like thrust are hard to figure out. I could have sworn I got it working once on my Mac laptop with like option right arrow to get it to go forward. But as of the time I wrote this review, I couldn't get that to work a second time. I could turn right and left slowly or quickly depending on whether I held on the option or command key, but I never was able to get that forward starting thing. Anyway, if you're good at flight simulators, I'm not, and you have a real keyboard, then I think you'll have a lot of fun crashing an F-16 in the desert. Try not to hit any houses, though, okay? So check out the Google Earth Flight Simulator. This week we have an interesting ad, if you will, for Honda Bob. He asked a question. If you've been playing along with our home game, you know that Honda Bob has been my mechanic for 29 years, and that he's built a fantastic resource for all of us in his website at hdabob.com. He's got detailed descriptions of each of the major components that make up the workings of a car, and for each of these major components, he tells you why you should care about it. He asked me to ask you what else you'd like to learn about cars so he can enhance his site even further. Hey, I got an idea. Maybe you should have a section on waxing and claying and polishing. Anyway, please send suggestions to his email address at hdabob@hdabob.com. And of course, if you're lucky enough to drive a Honda or an Acura, and you live in the Los Angeles or Orange County area, consider having Honda Bob drive to your house to do your maintenance and repairs while you relax in your own home. Give him a call at 562-531-2321. HGA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated in any way with Honda Motor Company. I think one of my favorite things about podcasting are the infinite possibilities available to podcast about. There's an audience for every person who is passionate about a subject. I have a great example to tell you about. My son has a close friend named Hank Nelson, who's a senior in high school. Hank is a fanatic about history. I don't just mean he likes it. He loves it. He reads it for pleasure, he collects historical memorabilia, and he loves to tell people the wonderful stories of the history of the world. I wish I'd had a history teacher with a passion and enthusiasm for history that Hank has about U.S. and European history. Hank and I got to talking one day last spring, and I got the wild idea that maybe he should do a podcast about history. He instantly loved the idea, and he ran with it. His will be a very different sort of podcast. He's creating a podcast that will follow the curriculum for the advanced placement European history classes taught in the United States. These classes follow a very prescribed curriculum that is identical across the country so that all students are prepared for the AP test at the end of the year, hoping to earn college credit for the class. Well, I wasn't sure he'd actually go through with it, so I was delighted to find out that Hank has already recorded 6 episodes for his podcast and will be releasing them on regular intervals to coincide with the curriculum. I know you've been chomping at the bit to know what the name of his site is. It's called HanksHistoryHour.com. If you know anyone taking European history in high school or just really, really interested in the subject, I can't encourage you enough to tell them about Hank's History Hour, because they could find no better storyteller and teacher than Hank Nelson. Plus, I created his WordPress blog, so it's got to be cool, right? Check it out and give him some encouragement. If you're a Mac shareware fanatic like me, you've probably heard of the developers over at FlyingMeat.com. They're the folks that wrote VoodooPad, FlySketch, and FlyGesture, which are some of Niraj's favorites. So recently, he turned me on to their newest product called Acorn, which is a new image editor, quote, with one goal in mind, simplicity. They claim that Acorn is fast, easy, and fluid, and provides the options you'll need without any overhead. At $39.95 US, they also point out that it won't drain your bank account. You know I like to start with a problem to be solved, and definitely having an alternative to the heavy, complex image editors that cost a fortune is solving a real problem. I downloaded and installed Acorn, and to my immediate delight, I noticed it was a whopping 14.2 megabytes in size. That's around 1/6 the size of Photoshop Elements, but until we assess the capabilities of Acorn, that might not be a fair comparison. After launching Acorn, I was shown 2 choices: create a new image or to edit an existing image. I opened an existing image, actually of Hank from Hank's History Hour, and decided to try to do some edits. My initial goal was to put the title of the podcast across the top and then save it to a smaller image appropriate for iTunes. Acorn does go for simplicity. The picture comes up full screen, which is great, along with a very small palette of tools. The image has the size in the bottom left-hand corner and a zoom slider in the bottom right, so there's very little clutter on the screen, which leaves a lot of room for the image. I like that a lot. I like the way the zoom slider works. If you click it on the left side, it makes the picture fit the window. Click it on the right, and it zooms to 200%. Might be a little better if it zoomed to 100%, which is what you frequently want to see. And of course, you can slide it to any point in between. The tools are in a text list on the left side of the palette, and as you click on each one, the right side changes to reflect the options for that tool. If you got the same favorites at your fingertips, along with some new ones, you have Move, Select, Draw, Flood Fill, Gradient, Text, and Shape. I read on the website that they have vector tools, and that could be really cool. Vector tools are items like lines and shapes that, instead of being bitmaps, that is, dots on the screen, they're actually objects that you can move around after you add them to the image. I tested this, and it worked really well. I drew a rectangle, filled it with red, and then changed the blending to Color Dodge. I was then able to drag it around over Hank's head, and it changed the color as I dragged it around. Pretty cool. I do wish they had arrows on the lines. That's one thing Photoshop Elements doesn't do, and I frequently want. Well, I have Sketch now, so I have that need filled. Putting arrows on things is the hardest thing, and Sketch just does it perfectly. One thing I noticed that it was slow to undo, which was kind of odd because all the other operations appeared fairly rapidly. When it comes to working with text, they have a WYSIWYG menu of fonts so you can easily pick what you want. I definitely like that. I was disappointed, though, in how many options are available of how much to dress up the text. I did stumble across a way to make it shadowed, but it was hard to find. You have to click a teeny-weeny itsy-bitsy little S above the font family to get to those options. But for many fonts, they didn't even have bold or italics as an option. Don't expect to be able to center or right justify text, and it has nothing like emboss or any of the layer styles you can get in Photoshop Elements. The color control was pretty basic. All I could find was saturation, brightness, and contrast, but no levels control with a histogram by color or anything like that a lot of the other programs have. I really depend on those tools for enhancing my photographs. I mean, come on, I can't be expected to actually expose my own pictures properly, now can I? What they did have in filters was pretty amazing. First of all, they had tons of them. All the posterize and blur and sharpen and color adjustment filters you could ever hope for. If you choose a filter, it comes up on screen with a green plus sign at the bottom, and if you click the plus sign, it adds that filter to the effect you're creating. So you can actually daisy chain a bunch of effects together and mess with their adjustment sliders independently. Every time you make a change to one of the filters, it updates the image showing you real time what it's going to look like when you're done. The website says that they actually use your graphics processing unit to do that, which I think is unusual. Usually how good your graphics card is doesn't matter in image editing programs. I really like that adding a filter method. I've never seen that in another program. Acorn has a built-in Flickr uploader, which makes it easy for you to upload your masterpieces. It also lets you take pictures with your iSight camera directly into Acorn. Two things I don't think I've ever seen in a program like this. Overall, I think Acorn is a nice little product with some basic capabilities to edit and enhance photographs, and a few features no one else has. The interface is simple and easy to follow, and it gets the job done. I do think, though, that there are web-based tools that can accomplish most of what Acorn can do, like Snipshot, Pixinate, and Photo, which I reviewed back on show numbers 91 and 92. Don't get me wrong, Acorn is a nice product, and with a few enhancements, I think it could be even better. Bart Bouchatz of bartbouchatz.ie/blog sent in another great review, this time on Apple's latest incarnation of Keynote.
Hi folks, this is Bart from bartbouchatz.ie back for another review with the NoSilicast. This week I'm going to look at one of the three applications that make up iWork. In this case I'm going to be looking at Keynote. Keynote is the oldest of the iWork applications and it's sort of in competition with PowerPoint for Microsoft Office. However, unlike NeoOffice and OpenOffice in general, you don't get the impression that iWork is trying to copy Microsoft Office. You get the impression it's trying to do the same thing, only to do it the Apple way. And in many ways, you could say it does a much better job. Being the most mature of the iWork apps, I suppose it's no surprise that Keynote is probably the very best of them. I haven't come across anything I can do in PowerPoint that I can't do in Keynote, but I've come across an awful lot that I can do in Keynote that I can't do in PowerPoint. When you fire up Keynote, it's sort of familiar, and yet not quite familiar. On the one hand, you have your little thumbnails of your slides down the side, you have your main window with your current slide in it, so in that regard, it's very familiar, it's very like any of the other similar applications. And yet, there's something subtly different. The screen seems much less cluttered, much simpler, much less intimidating, in fact. And that's because the menu bar at the top doesn't contain a whole sea of little tiny icons, little pictograms that are cryptic nonsense. Instead, it contains just a small selection of icons, all of which have text underneath them, which makes things probably quite a bit easier. So really, I guess that's the first thing I like about Keynote, and indeed iWork in general. The interface is much more mum-friendly, as I call it, and basically it's just neater, tidier, simpler, less intimidating, and just sort of lets you get on with it and gets out of your way, all of which I think are very good things. However, no review from me would ever be complete without some negative comments, so I have two gripes with Keynote, although in fairness they're quite minor really. The first one is with its inspector pane. So by default you fire up Keynote, the inspector pane is hidden, and you could be forgiven for thinking you have almost no control over anything. That's simply because you have to click on the I for inspector button, then the inspector pops up, it gives you 10 tabs into which all the different things are broken up. And, you know, it does work very well, but it's hidden by default and that's a little confusing. Now, the actual inspector is very sensible. They've broken things up in a sensible way, but you find yourself clicking over and back and over and back across these 10 tabs across the top of it all the time. What I really wish was that, you know, you could see multiple tabs of the inspector at the same time. In fact, I'd like them to use a model that Microsoft use in Office for Mac, and only in Office for Mac, where you have collapsible little mini-inspectors within your inspector pane, and so you can see slide properties and text properties at once, which you simply can't do with Apple's implementation. Apple's implementation works, but I think the other system works better, and I really wish they'd adopt that idea, not just for Keynote, but in fact for all of iWork and indeed all of iLife. The second of my minor gripes concerns a choice Apple have made in terms of their default settings, and I think it's an exceptionally silly choice. Now, it's a perfectly valid assumption that nowadays, your average projector has a resolution of 1024x768, and by default, that's exactly the resolution that keynote presentations are targeted at. Perfectly sensible default, no qualms there. However, if you have a display or a projector which has a higher resolution than that, and you fire up your presentation, it won't by default be scaled up. It will sit there at 1024x768 in the centre of the screen with lots of black space around it, basically wasting a load of real estate. I mean, come on, that's pretty silly. What makes it even worse is that Keynote is perfectly capable of scaling up your output to match the size of your display. It just doesn't do it by default, so you actually have to go digging around in the settings to change it. Really, Apple here could make a very big difference simply by making a sensible default instead of a very silly default. Okay, so that's enough of the negativity, because that really is the only things that annoyed me about Keynote. All the rest is all good stuff. The first thing you'll notice is that Keynote contains a good large helping of Apple polish. Everything simply looks shiny. You know, creating very nice looking graphs is absolutely trivial. They can be three-dimensional. If you make a pie chart, you can explode out the slice you're talking about. You can do really cool stuff, and it just looks fantastic, and it's all really easy to do. Similarly, if you add in images into your presentation, then you can choose how their borders are rendered, and you can do things like make them look like three-dimensional photographs that are sort of sitting on top of the page, make them look like they're held onto your presentation with a bit of sellotape, all sorts of cool border effects. It's just really nice, really shiny, and they generally really complement the default style you've chosen. And indeed, the default templates are fantastic. They're very professional looking, very, very nice, basically. What you also have over PowerPoint is a much bigger choice of transitions for your slides, a lot of very cool 3D effects, and it just gives it all that little bit more polish, which gives your presentation a little bit more edge, and you get all this extra shininess without any extra effort on your part. It's no harder to make a presentation with Keynote. In fact, it's probably easier than it is with PowerPoint, and it comes out looking better. That's bloody impressive. Now, Keynote does export PowerPoint files, so you can share presentations with your Windows users, but of course, when it exports to PowerPoint, you lose a lot of the shininess. Cool 3D transitions, gone, I'm afraid, because PowerPoint simply can't render them. However, your shiny graphs and your cool picture frames do transition over, but of course, they're not editable once you do, because what does Keynote have to do? Well, it converts your shiny graph to a plain ordinary image, sticks the image into the presentation, and then exports it to PowerPoint. I don't think there is a better way to bridge that gap in ability between Keynote and PowerPoint, so I see exactly why they did it, and it does basically work. But nonetheless, once you leave Keynote, you lose some of Keynote's shininess. Okay, so Keynote is very good at helping you make very shiny, very cool presentations very easily. Great, but its goodness doesn't stop there. It also helps you in the other and probably more crucial stage of actually making a presentation, presenting it. So, you're standing up there, you have your laptop in front of you, projector's going, and your slides are being projected behind you or next to you or whatever. With most presentation software, your laptop display will show the slides just like the projector is showing at the time. This is somewhat useful, as in you know what's on the screen behind your head without having to turn around and look at it. But it could do an awful lot more really when you think about it, and in Keynote it does. You get what's called the presenter view, and what you have there is it doesn't show you just the current slide, it shows you the current slide and the next slide, which is exceptionally useful, and it also shows you two clocks at the bottom of the screen. One of them is the current time, and the other one is how long you've been presenting. These are both very handy things to know while you're actually giving your talk, say if you're looking at your watch all the time and stuff like that. You know, I think that's a really nice touch, and when that came up on the screen when I was giving my presentation last week, I was like, oh, wow, they really have thought of stuff. No, it's just thoughtful, sensible. Now, all Macs come with the little Apple remote these days, so of course it makes absolutely perfect sense that the Apple remote should work with Keynote, and of course it does. So you can do the obvious. You can use the arrow keys on the remote to go next slide and previous slide. Great, but it does more than that. If you hit the menu button, you will get, on your presenter window only, a little sort of all your thumbnails of your slides. You can scan through them with the remote, select the slide, and then the show jumps to that slide. Of course, none of your audience have seen you doing all this poking around. It all happens on the presenter screen only. You know, simple little touches, but I think it's dead cool. It meant that when I was giving my talk, I was able to sort of walk around the room, work the room, and just click with my little Apple remote the whole time. It just made it all that little bit easier because I wasn't running over to the laptop to hit the spacebar key all the time. I could walk around the room to my heart's content and just click with the little remote. So, in summary, Keynote sets out to be the perfect program for helping you create and deliver very professional presentations as easily as possible. It doesn't set out to try to be a clone of PowerPoint, and to be honest with you, it's all the better an app because it doesn't have that aim. It lives up to its actual aim, which is what you really want to do, very well. It's just a nice program, and if you do have to present, this is definitely the way to do it. I've done a sort of a much more detailed written review of Keynote on my blog, and there's lots and lots of screenshots there of all the various things I've been talking about, and it goes through the same points in a little more detail. So, as ever, I'm going to ask Alison to stick a link into the show notes, and until next time, happy computing.
Hey, thanks, Bart. I really enjoy your reviews. You give great detail, and you're never a fanboy. If you think something's stupid in it, you tell us. I went through and read Bart's physics charts on his blog, and I really enjoyed them. He has a great way of explaining things. I'd love to have had him as a physics teacher. I had a dork named Mr. Pietro for physics. Hope Mr. Pietro's not out there listening. But anyway, in his keynote presentation that I put a link to on the blog, he takes a look at two of the big questions in modern physics as a way to get these young college students he was talking to more excited about what they can begin investigating as they launch into their physics careers. Even with little physics instruction since college, I was fascinated by his material. Plus, his charts look really cool. He picked a theme that looks like chalk on a chalkboard, so it's gotta be good. Check out the link in the show notes. I think almost anybody would be interested in the pieces that he put up there. It's pretty interesting. Thanks again for the great review, Bart. I'm actually not the crazy, out there on the bleeding edge person you think I am, but luckily there are people out there bleeding on the edge even further than I am. These people have gone out and at great personal risk to their own iPhones, they hacked them. All right, back up, Allison, we gotta have a problem statement here. Unfortunately, Apple did not think it was safe to let us have applications on our iPhones from third parties. They claimed they were worried about the stability if they let us do that. Might be a true worry, but that's not going to stop us, is it? They restricted developers to web-based applications, and while the developers have been very active and creative, it's just not the same experience. The good news is that the folks over at iPhone.nullriver.com circumvented that restriction and have created a way for developers to make third-party applications. Here's what you have to do in order to make this particular hack work effectively. First, go to iPhone.nullriver.com and install the app.tap. Installer on your Mac. I was confused originally because I navigated to this website using my iPhone, but you can't install it on the iPhone. I was also confused when I did install it on my Mac because it seemed to be taking forever to install until I looked at the window closely and realized it said, waiting for iPhone. I hadn't plugged my iPhone into my Mac, so it was going to wait a long time. When I finally did, the software automatically put itself on the iPhone. Very slick. I bet that was in the instructions somewhere, but we don't need no stinking instructions. All right, now, once I've done that, I've got a file called installer on the bottom row where there were never applications before. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but there's a blank row at the bottom. You're shown an application created by Null River called installer. When you open the installer, you're shown some applications which have been created by Null River, and they, to some extent, imply that they're well-tested and all that. They've gone to great pains, though, to make this an open development environment, so they include a button for community sources, and once you go in there, there's tons of applications to install. I ran out and I threw a whole bunch of interesting applications on right away. I'll tell you more about those in a minute, but first, there's a problem with this. There's only four spots in the bottom row, and one spot is taken by the installer. So what happens when you load the fifth item? Well, one of the early ones you installed just stops being invisible to you. It falls off of the list. But it's still installed. This is a crisis. What do we do? Well, luckily, Null River wrote another application called Summerboard. Summerboard is a play on words for Springboard, which is what Apple calls the home screen. Summerboard changes Springboard so that the applications can actually scroll vertically on the screen so you can see more of them. I installed Summerboard, now I can see all the application I installed, and I'm tempted to install some more now. So, what applications did I desperately need? Well, a real chat client, for one. Apple, for some reason, did not include iChat, but only SMS text messaging. Sounds like a revenue thing to me, since they charge for text messages. And they don't for data. I had tried some of the web-based solutions, and while they did technically work, they were poor substitutes. They had a lag that was just too big when trying to chat, and then the application would have to go out and refresh a web page. I installed an application called Mobile Chat from 2008.com, and it works pretty darn good. They actually already did an upgrade since I installed it, and that makes it work even better. It used to not show you the text of a second line you were writing because the window was too small, but now it scrolls to the second line when you type too long and you can see it. It still does have a little bug where it scrolls the whole screen to the top every time you get a new message, which is kind of lame, but you can scroll back down to where the conversation is. I think it's like a really super beta product, so I'll give them some time to fix that. I do like the way the application installer works on from Null River. One of the tabs is for updates, so if you glance in there once in a while, you'll be able to see any updates that might have come in for your applications. All right, enough about chat. I also installed the BSD subsystem so that I can install the terminal. Why would I want the terminal? Obviously, so I can impress my Unix geek friends by typing in things like ls space dash al. That's why. It's really, really, really hard to use because the text is like micro print. I think it's like 2.5 point. And the delete key doesn't work. So when you make mistakes, you got to hit a character turn, start over. So it's pretty useless. But I was able to change directories into the applications folder and see all my applications. So that was awesome. I also installed a voice recorder application too. I don't need that either, but it was pretty interesting to know that the iPhone can record sound. Very clever, these developers. Finally, I installed the most important and useful application on my entire iPhone. It's called Sketches, and it makes your iPhone into an Etch-a-Sketch. I have gotten more attention and fun out of this application than anything else on the phone. The folks over at sketches.latenightsoftware.com have broken the barrier that I think will encourage millions of people to adopt the iPhone now as their primary electronic device. I mean, come on. It's an Etch-a-Sketch, too. What more could you want? Anyway, I figured this description would be even more fun if I made a video of the experience, so I put one up on YouTube, and you can go over and view it in the show notes. You can hear my glee at getting an Etch-a-Sketch on my iPhone in the video one more time. Well, I think that's going to wind things up for today's show, and again, I've really been enjoying all the fun emails. So keep sending them in to allison@podfeet.com, or if you're feeling brave, send in an audio comment or suggestion to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.